So after our series that we had last month, or earlier this month, on faith, there was wild enthusiasm for having particular themes and titles for these monthly gatherings, and so I was quite happy to go along with that, and so we came up with a few titles for this evening and for the next few events, and that was mentioned earlier this evening, that next one will be death and dying, and then after that forgiveness. But maybe this evening's theme of relationship and sexuality is probably a good preface to death and dying and forgiveness. We have to get born before we die, you know. So. And so these are all very central themes, aspects of life which are very important, significant for all of us in different ways. And so I will offer some reflections on this this area this evening, and then, as I said, open things up for a discussion later on. Well, maybe first of all to talk about relationship, and to begin by saying pointing out there's many different ways that we can relate to each other as human beings, and I'm not absolutely sure what implications would be just within the title of the evening of relationship and sexuality, but to me it's just considering the whole area of relationship is important, how we as human beings relate to each other, whether it's parent to child, to partner to partner, sibling to sibling, teacher to student, whatever it might be, or stranger to stranger. You know, the whole question of how we connect with other human beings is very important. So, because in a way the mind might think, well, the relationship between two lovers is very different than between a parent and a child, or between two siblings, or between a teacher and a student. And so it's very easy for the attention to get drawn by, you know, that particular dimension and think, well, these are the significant differences lie in these different qualities of relationship. But what I thought when considering this evening, that in a way it's a different dimension that really makes is of the greatest significance, a different way of slicing the pie, as it were. Because whether the relationships are romantic or platonic, or teacher to student, or parent to child, or between siblings or strangers or whatever, the main difference is between what I would call relationships of separateness and relationships of wholeness. So I thought I would, and these are terms that I like to use, and so I thought I'd frame the evening's reflections about that, around that kind of terminology. So what I mean by these is like a relationship of separateness is where we base our connection with another on a very definite sense of me and you. Like, I am the child, you are the parent, or I am the wife, you are the husband, I am the teacher, you are the student. Where the mind creates a very solid I and you. There is me here and you there. And that structure goes completely unquestioned. It's set up in a completely unquestioned way. And so whether it's a romantic relationship or a parent-child relationship, whatever, that we can, as we're all familiar, these can be very, very solid and fixed perceptions in our minds. And that these kind of relationships can very easily devolve into it's your job to make me happy ideas. And if I'm not happy or if I'm suffering, it's your fault. If, you know, like I'm the parent and you're the child that's disobeying me, or, you know, I'm the partner and, you know, you're not being the way I want you to be, you're doing something that's annoying me. Or the other way around, I want to make you happy and you're not happy, therefore it's my fault. You know, these different dimensions that we can have. Certainly I'm very happy to open things up, you know, for discussion, and we can introduce your own particular flavors or takes on this later on in the evening. But certainly my experience has been that this is when we form a relationship or a way of relating with others in this mode of separateness, it very easily devolves to that, and a sense of expectation. And that so we can try very hard to get closer or to make things right. So I'll do things different to make you happy, or I'll do something to please my parents or please my children or please my teacher. Well, you know, in a traditional religious situation or in a monastery, it's like, what can I do to make the teacher happy? You know, he's scowling. what can I do to make the teacher light up? Or, you know, all of us with parents who have had parents, what can I do to make, you know, mom look, look more cheerful? Or how can I make dad happy? He's always so grumpy. What do I do to get that that hit of the other being pleased? And so we can try very, very hard to get that effect, and then we call that happiness. That's sort of success and goodness, is that creating that effect. But probably most of us in this room have had the experience whereby no matter how hard we try, it doesn't always work, and we can try and get closer and closer, trying pleasing our partner, or trying to please our parent, or our child, or trying to get kind of totally close and totally fused with the other, and have that fulfilled feeling, that quality of completeness there all the time. But it keeps evading us, keeps slipping through our fingers, and particularly in romantic relationships, it can become really so heartbreaking. You try everything you can to get close, but the harder you try, then the more there can be a barrier between you and others. And it's not just in romantic relationships. It can also be there with looking for the right teacher, in spiritual terms. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the René Magritte painting called The Lovers. Somebody groan. Yes. The Lovers, where this is a somewhat brutal but highly accurate description of a human experience, where the two lovers, two people are wrapped around each other, embracing, but a man and a woman, but they both have a bag over their heads. Each one has an individual bag, and they're kind of wrapped around each other in this embrace, but each one has a black bag over their head, so that each one is completely encased in their own world. So that the gesture is one of embrace, but there's this this division, the layers of cloth that are dividing them. And probably all of us have had that kind of experience in one way or another. And so our response is generally, well, grip tighter, get closer. And in the spiritual domain, looking for the right teacher, or trying to get close to the teacher, or be at one with the teaching, the teacher, can be similarly frustrating. There was a famous story of within our community of a man who'd been traveling all over Asia. This was back in the 70s, and he'd been to visit, those of us who are of a certain age will recognize these names. Well, back in the 70s, there was Swami Muktananda and Neem Karoli Baba and Nisargadatta Maharaj in India, and in Thailand. He'd been to see Mahasi Sayadaw in Burma, and in Thailand been to see Ajahn Buddhadasa and Ajahn Mahabur, and all these great sages and gurus and enlightened beings all over Asia. And each one seemed to have something wrong with them. And this fellow, very ardent, sort of Northern European, serious spiritual seeker, came to Ajahn Chah, and was describing how he'd been for more than 10 years. He'd been on this journey, and Nisargadatta smokes bidis, and Neem Karoli Baba is really fat and is obsessed with food, and is a kind of a food religion. And Ajahn Mahabur was really angry, and Buddhadasa was really cold, and Mahasi Sayadaw just wasn't even there. He didn't even exist, had no personality whatsoever. and one after another, all these things, these wonderful enlightened beings, there was always something wrong with them. And Ajahn Chah said, do you know what you're looking for? And he said, yes, I'm looking for my teacher. He says, no, no, you're looking for a turtle with a moustache. And Ajahn Sumedho was an American monk, was translating, and he thought, what? He said, did I get that right? He said, yeah, it's like a turtle with a moustache. And Ajahn Chah said, yeah, that's right. So, okay, he says, well, he says you're looking for a turtle with a moustache. He says, what do you mean? He says, you're looking for something that doesn't exist. You know, you're looking for someone who can please you all of the time, who will never upset your feelings and never disappoint you. He says, such a being does not exist in the world and cannot exist. If you want to learn, I'm happy to teach you. You can stay here. But I guarantee there'll be times when I annoy you and you're upset with me and you feel that I'm failing you. And I know that that will be the case. But I know that that's always going to be true. And you should understand that that's just the nature of the human mind and the quality of desire, that no being, no thing in the world can possibly please us and satisfy us all of the time. It can't be that way. That's not the way nature works. So if you want to stay here and learn, you can. If you want to travel on then and look for your perfect teacher, then please carry on with your search. And as it happened, he stayed for a couple of days and then maybe he is in this room tonight. The search carried on for another 2 or 3 decades. So this is what I would call a relationship of separateness, where there's this fixed view, or what we would call self-view. It's a view based on me and you, and a rigid perception of self and other. Even if we're desperately adore the other and trying to get close, something seems to get in the way, or something can't satisfy us, and we end up feeling alienated or lost, or there's always a piece missing. Now, in sexual desire, obviously, when that is in the mixture as well, then that intensifies that process very, very easily. And I think it's important to understand, sexual desire is obviously the way we all got here, If you remember your biology classes, all of us were born because our parents had sex with each other, or at least somebody went to the fertility lab, that's how we got born. And sex, at least on this planet, has been going on for about 1 billion years. First couple of 1 billion years, there was no life on the planet. About 2 billion years ago, the first kinds of primordial cellular structures started to happen, it took about 1 billion years to get more kind of complex cellular systems. Kind of, there were little protozoans, small monocellular plants and animals started to come into being about 1 billion years ago. So that's when sexual desire started to appear. It was where it started nature started to develop the male female structure. Before that, it was a lot simpler. You just divided. Probably less fun, but that's the way it was for the first 1 billion years of living systems. It was just division was the only option. So then if you consider that for 1 billion years this system of sexual reproduction has been happening, this is very deeply ingrained stuff in our system, and it's when we are considering sexual desire and how sexuality fits into the human world, it's in a way really important to consider just how deeply rooted this is. This is like fundamental to every cell in the body. Is imprinted in this way, and so that it's important to recognize these are very powerful primordial forces that it's what gets us born in the first place. And and the Buddha also recognized this and pointed out that in one of the teachings from the northern tradition, that in the Sutra of 42 sections, the Buddha says, Sexual desire is the most powerful force in the universe. If there were two forces as powerful as this, there would be no hope for escape from any for any being from samsara. Should I say that again? That sexual desire is the most powerful force in the universe. If there were two forces as powerful as this, there would be no hope for any being to escape from samsara, to transcend the cycles of birth and death, and to realize true freedom. So, powerful stuff. And in the southern Buddhist scriptures, the Buddha says a similar thing. He says, there's nothing more powerful to the mind of a human being than the sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch of another human being that they're sexually attracted to. Nothing more powerful. So this is, in a way, and one of the things that attracted me to Buddhism in the first place was a fundamental realism. It's like, this is powerful stuff, and not to be messed with. And if you also recognize that this is so deeply ingrained in our system, even though the mind on the thinking level might say, well, you know, I like this particular kind of person, or that particular kind of person, or this sort of color hair, or that particular kind of personality, or this shade, and I like these particular qualities, and these political views, and these particular nuances. That's very much at the surface level. That on a basic sort of chemical level, the whole dimension of the brain which works on sexual desire is way sort of pre-verbal. We're down in the reptile brain, or pre-reptile brain, it's called brainstem area. It's like, you know, even when our ancestors, who are little protozoans, little sort of monocellular creatures, even they had like the three basic desires of, can I eat it? Is it going to eat me? Can I mate with it? Right? I mean, how much of our life is based around this? Really, you know, I mean, we dress ourselves up in all kinds of sophisticated ways and have all sorts of laws and structures and social graces, but really, is it, can I eat it? Will it eat me? Can I mate with it? I mean, I don't think I'm being too blunt. But it's, you know, we do dress these things up in all kinds of sophisticated ways, but a lot of it is really around that. So what that means is we need to be aware of how deeply and how fully those kind of forces can color the way that we perceive the world. And how strongly we can be drawn into this kind of relation, the sort of relating to others in this way of one, you know, just following sexual desire to try and find that thing which is going to make me complete, that other person, that kind of contact, that hit that's going to make me whole and complete and happy forever. And that's what that's why advertising uses sexual desire to sell stuff, because even if it's selling spark plugs, you know, it's like, buy these spark plugs and you'll be happy forever, because there's some attractive being, some kind of burly guy or some sexy woman holding the spark plug. It's a spark plug, you know, it's not got any intrinsic sexual appeal, but they'll, you know, the people who are trying to sell spark plugs will use that because they know, well, you associate the spark plug with the sexual hit, and the brain is hardwired enough to go, yeah, and not notice that you just bought the spark plug rather than the attractive person that was holding it. That's how the advertising industry works, right? You know, these are not secrets, because of the strength of that pull. And then what happens is we get disappointed, you know, that the spark plug just helps the car to go, but it doesn't make us happy forever. So that it's, in a way, understanding the strength of the force, and also appreciating the kind of disappointment that we can be left with if our way of relating just gets stuck at this level of separateness, or wanting something, some person to complete me and make me whole. So then, moving on to the what I would call the relationships of wholeness. This is where the way that we relate with others, whether it's a romantic relationship or a spiritual relationship, or, you know, parent-child, or sibling to sibling, or teacher to student, is not based on this rigid sense of me and you, of self and other. but is based more on a letting go of self, a letting go of that duality. And so in spiritual paths, even though you might have, a path of devotion, like say towards Krishna or the Divine Mother or Jesus or Mary or whoever, and even in Buddhist tradition they use deity yoga. There's a way that the divine object or the divine being is there as an object of love and devotion, but that also is developed in a way to reflect that actually is a quality of your own nature, that one is being devoted to, that the beloved is actually your own a quality of your own heart, your own nature, and it's sort of embodied or exemplified externally, but it's really talking about a quality within ourselves. So then when we base our relationship on that a sense of wholeness, we're moving away from that sense of I need you to complete me, I need you to make me whole, but it's more of based upon a letting go, and in a way trusting our own completeness, recognizing an intrinsic wholeness within ourselves. And so that it may be that the presence of the other helps us to be reminded of our own wholeness. It's like Stephen Levine, and Stephen and Andrea have a whole massive catalogue of spiritual one-liners. And one of his was, the one you love is a mirror for that in you which is love. Which is a nice one to remember. The one you love is a mirror for that in you which is love. And Shelley actually said it earlier. Percy Shelley said, as each are mirrors of the fire for which all thirst. As each of us are mirrors of the fire for which all thirst. Like that, within us is that fullness of being, that fundamental wholeness, and the presence of the other, whether it's your beloved or your parent or your child or the great mother or Jesus or whoever, that's reflecting back or helping us to remember, oh yes, I'm complete already. Aha, how did I forget? And so in Buddhist practice, particularly in Theravada Buddhism, which is the lineage that we come from, there's much more of it's a much more of a non-personal expression. So we don't really use that kind of language of, say, the beloved, devotion to the beloved, or guru devotion in such a way. In Northern Buddhism, they use it a lot more. But it's even in the Southern Buddhist tradition, we have Buddha images, we have shrines, we do a lot of bowing and all of that, so that there is still that same sort of quality. But you're recognizing when you say, when you're bowing to the Buddha, as I mentioned a number of times at these gatherings, we're bowing to awakenedness. We're bowing to the wisdom of our own heart rather than just bowing to the memory of Gautama Buddha or bowing to a shrine. When that is completed or fulfilled, then we're bowing to that innate quality of our own heart. So then a relationship of wholeness is fundamentally based on this kind of quality of respect and kindness and appreciation for others, but also not solidifying others. I remember many, many years ago, one of the nuns in our community had a very tense, difficult relationship with her parents. And she was very worried about going back to stay with them as a nun, and she was anxious about what she should do, what she should say, and how she should what she should do to sort of make them feel all right and to be happy and to make everything okay. And just the way that she put the question to our teacher Ajahn Sumedho alerted him to this, and what he responded was this. You could see it wasn't something that he'd had framed in his mind beforehand, but it just came out in that moment, perfectly phrased, which was, the kindest thing that you can do for your parents is not to create them. So, substitute the kindest thing you can do for your partner, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your child, your parent, your teacher. The kindest thing that we can do for those that we love is not to create them. Which doesn't mean to sort of switch off or ignore, but to not solidify, to not fix the mind in that sense of me here and you there, but to be letting us remind each other of our own wholeness, our own completeness. That way, then, whereas a relationship of separateness devolves to a kind of either the other becomes an intruder, or the missing piece. then we relate to that whole dimension in a very, very different way, and so that then our contact with others helps us to awaken to that intrinsic quality, and awakens to what we call the unconditioned or the unborn, the immortal quality of our own nature. And we begin to realize that that's actually what freedom is. Because the more that we depend on others to make us happy or make us feel complete or make us feel secure, we're in a very confined and imprisoned state. We are not free because we need all this stuff around. We need these people around. And not only do we need the people, we need them to be a certain way. Because if he looks like that, oh dear, you know, he's upset, or, you know, what am I going to do? You know, he's freaking out, or she's kind of losing it again. And what can I do to make him happy, her happy, it happy, the system happy? You know, the other monks and novices in the monastery, oh dear, you know, they're looking grumpy again. Then we're in an imprisoned state. We're not free, because we have to have all these things in place in order for us to feel good. And it's a strange thing that it's when we form our relationships around relinquishment, letting each other go. And I remember also one of our friends years ago talking about the practice of renunciation, is saying and talking about the celibate life and the monastic spirit. He said, and he was a layman who wrote this, said, they love the world so much they have let go of it completely. That was a wonderful thought. Wish I'd thought of that. But I'll give our friend Ryan the credit. They love the world so much they've let go of it completely. And recognizing that this is a quality of freedom, because when we look towards our relationships in this unneedy way, where we're not looking for others or the world to complete us or provide our security, then whether people scowl at us and they feel grumpy, or whether they feel good and happy, then we're okay either way. We are able to be with that, and we help where we can, and we rejoice where we can. But we're not, our own happiness, our own wholeness, our own security is not dependent on the moods and feelings of others and the world. And so it's important to understand that in a way celibacy and the way that functions within the world, because oftentimes people think, well, those who've given up on sexual activity, like, you know, the monks and nuns and novices and so forth, well, that somehow we're kind of revolting against the world, or that you know, actually that ordinary life is to be sexually active, or is a sort of a sexual based relation, way of relating, and these monastics are kind of doing something totally different. I remember someone pointing out that actually most people are celibate most of their lives. You know, the actual amount of time during the course of the day, even someone who thinks of themselves as being sexually active or actually engaging in that way, is pretty small, really. And for huge areas of our life, you know, we're totally celibate. And so that it's more recognizing that that rather than thinking of celibacy as some kind of totally different thing, it's actually a very common way that we all function. And also, and more importantly, it's reflecting a dimension of our being to which sexuality does not apply. There's that in us which is utterly uninterested in sexual activity. And so that sometimes people will think, well, celibacy means you have to be suppressing sexual desire, because if you're not acting on it, then you know, you must be bottling it up and feeling very frustrated. But if you look, all of us recognize there's a whole dimension of our being, you know, often in our clearest moments, and sometimes mysteriously enough, even in the middle of sexual activity, where somehow it doesn't matter. That there's absolutely nothing missing. I mean, I only mentioned this not because, you know, of my own particular experience, but someone was saying how it was it had this moment of great insight in the middle of the sexual act of realizing this is utterly, I'm actually not interested in sex at all. And not as though he was sort of just becoming, you know, inert or kind of unfeeling, but just like, this isn't really about sex at all. This is something else. So that what we find is that there is that dimension of our being, what we would call the unconditional, the unborn, the pure heart, which is utterly complete and free in its own nature, and does not need to be engaged with another, or to have anything, or get anything, possess anything, engage with another, in order to be complete. And so that celibacy is a way of, say, it's a kind of systematizing of a way to tap into or remember that quality of innate wholeness. There's a famous Christian theologian called Raimundo Panikkar, who has a beautiful book called Blessed Simplicity, and he says, points out how, you know, everyone has a nun or a monk inside them, and so that it's just that those of us who are monastics simply have formalized a relationship with that that inner monastic, and that it's tapping into a dimension of our nature. Which in a way that we remember when we were little children, where, you know, sexual activity was not an issue. It was not something that we were missing because it just didn't belong. It wasn't there. And so it's not as though we're trying to be infantile, but just looking at that area of our life that does not pertain, and that recognizing that when we awaken to that dimension, there's a quality of immense fullness and completeness there. And sometimes the pursuit of sexual pleasure or sexual engagement can be the very thing that blocks us from recognizing that innate wholeness and beauty. When it's very frustrating and disappointing, because sexual activity is promising that at the same time, but yet pursuing it and trying to find it through that means can often be the very thing that gets in the way. So that going on retreat or just sitting in meditation or going to stay in a monastery can simply be a way, like a means of helping us to awaken to that innate wholeness, that innate purity, innate beauty that is always here, it's never been lost, and that it's just a way that can help us to remember that more easily and more completely and more consistently. So these are some of these themes I will offer for reflection this evening. I hope some of it is useful, and anything that is not, please just leave aside. But I'm happy to open things up for questions and for some discussion. I know I tend to produce a flood of verbiage and stun everybody into silence, but I'm not the only one who has to speak here.
Well, I'll ask a question. One of the things we were talking about this week was Rilke's quote, where he says, I mean, you could see it as diametrically opposite to what you're saying, but you could also see it as exactly the same. Mm-hmm. But he says that actually everything is sexual. There's nothing that isn't sexual. It's just as children, you know, we are totally sexual beings. It's just not, as we age, we lose the beauty of that, and it gets just narrowed down to a couple of parts of our body. becomes very, very narrow. And so that, you know, that we've been talking about the loss of the beauty of sexuality, but our society is very afraid of sexuality because of its link to sexuality. Just throw that out.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it depends how you define sexuality. I mean, I think Rilke is probably a good example, since he was obsessed with feeling and emotion, but was incapable of any kind of relationship with other human beings. You know, if I remember Rilke's life story very, very well, you know, and that in a way, that's that, because he lived a very monastic life. Yeah.
In his exquisite,
exquisite poetry, yeah. And filled with amazing feeling, and it was an extraordinarily accurate and a heartfelt sense of the feelingness of the universe. I mean, German is not an easy language to bring across the sort of transcendent emotionality. Yeah, and so you know. It's extraordinary, but I would say that the way that Rilke is using the word sexuality is more like a all-encompassing openness, you know, a receptivity to all things, the readiness to unite with everything, to receive everything, to belong to everything. So in a way, that you could say that's exactly the same thing as what I'm describing, is that and that whether you call that the other or you call it yourself, it's like an openness to the universe, but it's also a complete self-reliance in the, you know, that there's a that the more that you don't need anything, then the more you can fully be open to everything. I mean, it's tricky to describe how it works, but in a way, the more the mind gets narrowed down to particular needs or wants or patterns, then the less we can really be open, because we find ourselves defended against this and, you know, fixated upon that, and there can't be that of undifferentiated, unbiased openness to all things. Yes. Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment, not really have a question. Because I've been married 31 years, I recognize that I have a lump in me, but I hold the piece of relating in relationship probably for the similar amount of years that you've held lumpiness with the other part of you, in the interior way. And I would say it's my experience that you accurately portrayed for me what a relationship was in the beginning. I wanted my mate to make me happy. If only he would meditate more, if only, you know, he would sense what it was like to do blah, blah, blah. And at some point, I saw the futility of that, if I wanted to stay with this person and that thinking, you know, I could surrender to something else. Or at least some of the time I can say something else. I'm a human being, so it's something that occurs every moment. But I also want to say that that abandon, that sense of connection you're speaking of, can be, that sex can be an incredible possibility, just like sitting in meditation can be of that union and that beyond self, through the physicality. And as a woman, I really feel the need to name that in the world, because, you know, I've had love to have children, and that also, as much as it's, there could be attachment with children, mm-hmm. there's also this amazing sense of beyond oneself and beyond the self. In that experience, and I think it's really important for me to honor that and to realize the gift of connection, the sense of feeling beyond myself in the numinous, whatever you want to call it,
Yeah, I mean, I certainly acknowledge that, and I realized when they suggested the topic for the evening, I said, well, you know, I'm a monk. I've been celibate since I was 21. You know, I've never had children. Yeah, and so I feel a bit cheeky, sort of coming across a little authoritative about a subject in a way, but it's important. I mean, the point that you make is important, because I don't want to come across and saying that sort of celibacy or is the sort of the one true way, but it, in a way, like I was saying, that's why I like to talk about it in terms of relationships of wholeness and separateness. That a married relationship or a romantic relationship that's a relationship of wholeness, that will lead to genuine freedom as much, whereas, say, a monastic life of committed celibacy that's based on, I'm a true sort of Theravadan Buddhist monk and, I've been keeping the rules for decades, you can be totally imprisoned in that. So that's why I prefer to use that language and to make the division, not whether it's parent-child or monk-nun and teacher-student, but more what's the quality of wholeness. And as you said, you started out the relationship in a way of separateness and something in you said, this is not working. And I think that that's, in a sense, that intuitive wisdom of our own heart that says, I'm in prison here, or this is not working, or there's something radically wrong. And then something, if we're wise, we listen to that and we begin to let go. And as you said, you realized something, or you saw something. You didn't say what it was that you saw. But I think we all phrase it in different ways, if we phrase it at all. But there's an intuitive sense of recognizing that we're hanging on to something and we need to change our view or change the way that we're holding things, and that certainly the quality to go by is the experience of freedom that we realize. That's the thing to judge by. Does the way that we act and the things that we hold to in our life, does it bring freedom or does it bring more dependency and alienation? What's the result? And so that if that comes through sort of devotion to another person, or through having children, or through loving a deity, or through meditation practice and celibacy and retreat, the point is freedom, not the methodology whereby we arrive at it. Yeah.
If I heard it correctly, the quote that you offered from Shelley kind of ties together all the comments that have been made, because whether it's a child or a partner or a passion for your work or whatever, or a passion for nature, those are all just mirrors for the fire. Is that quote?
Yeah. Right? As each are mirrors of the fire for which all thirst. Comes in his... Actually, it's his elegy for Keats, Adonais. That's the it was like on the death of his friend. It was written in, on the death of his friend John Keats. Yeah, and that it's that recognizing that it's the the fire, the fire of the divine or the transcendent, the holy, that is what draws us, and what the heart recognizes, whether it's in a moment of transcendent bliss with sexual union, or meditation experience, or falling off a mountain, whatever it might be, there's different things that bring us to those moments of epiphany, that something in the heart recognizes, oh yeah, this is freedom.
The Is there, can you recall that line where Ananda, when we were talking about relationships and how important they are in life?
Spiritual friendship.
Yes.
Yeah. Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant, and close relative and friend for many years, and also known as the softy of the Sangha. He was always the one who was making sure everyone was all right, and sort of sorting everything out and looking after the visitors to the Buddha and taking care of everybody. The story, it starts with him having a discussion with another monk, and this other monk is a real sort of meditation fanatic, and he's saying, you know, the concentration and insight, these are the whole of the spiritual life. And Ananda says, well, no, I think spiritual friendship is half of the holy life. And they go back and forth for a while, and then they say, well, let's go and take this to the Buddha. So then they bring this question to the Buddha, and then Ananda says, isn't it the case that spiritual friendship is half of the holy life? And then the Buddha says, not so, Ananda, which, as most people probably recognize, the Buddha was very fond of saying, not so, Ananda. Spiritual friendship is not half of the holy life, it is the whole of the holy life. And in a way, actually, that particular teaching, in it, sums up the evening's theme, because you know, the Buddha was very good at these shock tactics, and so what, the whole, what about, you know, how could that be? Is he saying that it's having, you know, good friends is the whole of the spiritual life? And then he says, well, the one dimension of it is the external, that being in association with those who are wise, those who are kind, those who are virtuous, is of essential importance. But then he turns it around and says, not only spiritual friendship, but also friendship with the spiritual. And so the other dimension is the internal dimension. So, and he says, and what is friendship, what is association, what is affiliation with the lovely, with the Kalyana, with the spiritual? And then he describes that as the practice of the Eightfold Path, or the practice of virtue, concentration, and wisdom. That's how there is affiliation, association with the lovely, with the beautiful, with, you know, capital L, capital B, with the holy. And so that then he points out how that's how, you know, the spiritual friendship is fulfilled, or that's how it is the whole of the holy life, is that it has these two dimensions. It's like association with the spiritual, in terms of your connection with others, but also the way you really connect with others in a spiritual way is that you practice wisdom and concentration and virtue. That's how that the connection is purified, as it were. So that it's you know, it's talking about the how we can really establish the relationships of wholeness. Because you can't just have the idea, like, yeah, that sounds great, I'm going to put that on my fridge and, you know, get a bumper sticker and, you know, tell the world this is the way, you know. It's like we actually have to bring about a change within ourselves through the moment-to-moment and practice of wisdom and recognizing, you know, the true nature of experience and the fundamental qualities of nature and reality. And the capacity of, you know, training the mind and living harmoniously. These are the ways that we can bring that, we can turn the idea of a relationship of wholeness from just, you know, a nice idea into the actuality of the way that we relate. Yeah.
Something that just came up for me was this concept of relationship that we've been discussing, and how it can relate that to even words and ideas that we hold on to or attach to in life. And I suppose it's probably safe to assume for most of us in this room, we understand when you bring up the ideas of wholeness and sort of the almost contradictory concept of and finding that wholeness within ourselves, we create sort of a detachment that makes sense to us. But in my experience, I've had someone in my life where that concept almost became an utter affront to them, to the point where it was causing much suffering in a relationship. And I was wondering what your thoughts were.
Well, the concept can be an affront, but if there's a genuine, it's a mysterious thing. But the more fully you realize that quality within yourself, the closer that you are to others. It's like the more that you, the more that you are completely self-reliant, the more totally you are able to connect with others. And that it's not just an idea; it's like an energetic connection. And so that's one of the most mysterious things, is that someone who's utterly detached, you find you just want to be around them all the time because it's so great to be near them, you know. But they just don't care about anything. But it's not like I don't care about anything. I'm frozen. You know,
it's
an utter. It's that sort of like Rilke's utter, abandonment to the universe and sort of complete acceptance of everything. It's like that someone who's not hanging on to anything. It's like you want to be around them all the time, and that part of you knows that they don't care about me at all. But also something in you knows that they love me more and know me more completely than anybody else that you could imagine. So it's a whole, it's a different way. If it's like I am being a self-reliant person, then it's someone's going to come along and say, "Hello, let me in. Hello, anybody there?" It's going to annoy the hell out of them, And sometimes, it's also just the way that we talk can, and expressions that we use can set off other people's alarms. And even if we don't mean to, we can just express things in ways that have a very sort of negative effect, and it can take a bit of even though the genuine feeling might be there, just the way that we've expressed something can be really alarming or off-putting. And sometimes others are just determined to see things in a particular way,
So is the advice that you would give to simply continue in one's own practice across the board?
That's a pretty broad statement, yeah. But yeah, I would... You certainly want to take into account, she really didn't like that. Notes. Well, that one didn't work. Right. Okay, duly noted. And so then that self, that sort of self-examination. Okay, well, what caused that? Or, wow, that was a really, that was a wild one. What happened there? And to just open yourself to that and just to recognize that sometimes there's no thing that we can do to make it right, and that just in a way what I would encourage is a more complete and a real sense of not trying to create the other, because trying to make it right between you and the other, oh dear, I've upset her or him, or what can I do to make it right? Then even though there's a sincere motivation, unconsciously we can be making more and more concrete. There's a there's the other there, and there's me here, and I've got to do something here to make it right between us. And the harder you try to make it right, even though it's well intentioned, the road to hell is paved with that particular substance. And so, in terms of practicing more fully and completely, it's like, let go of them, let go of yourself. And which in a way is a greater openness to the present moment. And sometimes that can, that can manifest in ways that you don't expect, like saying, that was really upsetting, wasn't it? Yeah, I didn't mean to do that to you, sorry. And then, right, I was upset. And then you find a closeness that you wouldn't necessarily have found. But that letting go of preconceptions and habitual views and that me trying to get things rightness, and really a genuine attuning of the heart to the present, that's always going to be beneficial. But it takes a lot of practice to do that, to be in the presence of others and not create them, like when's the evening at Yomo coming along and not creating you. I used to, when I first was teaching and running retreats and such like, I used to get these, talk about self-other experiences. It was like, them. I've got to please them. I've got to say things that are helpful to them. And I don't want to say anything that they will be upset about or won't be inspiring. And there was this incredible tension, would build up about trying to be a sort of successful Dharma teacher. I find myself a few days into a retreat and I realize they're not the enemy. They're not even them. It's like, we're all in this together, we're just sharing, there's just a bunch of reputed, apparent beings sharing a space, relax. It's just a week in the country, right? But it's, this is so easy for us to do, even in when what you're coming out of your mouth is all these sort of high refined Dhamma teachings. If it's me here trying to say the right things for you there, then it's, you're stuck in that self-other nightmare again. And that the even though you're talking about freedom all evening, you're in a little cage. you're locked in your prison of self and other. And that so it's just that sense of freeing each other up, giving each other space and giving yourself space. And then that's the mysterious thing, is that letting go of each other is exactly what brings you closer than you could ever imagine. It's a mysterious thing. Well, that's how it works, is that those who have let go of the world completely are the ones who find themselves most totally at home in the world and at one with it. It's just strange. That's how it works, I would say. Yes.
By the end of the week, I'll have been gone from home 3.5 weeks. And last week, I had a visit with my mother-in-law. And in my father-in-law, we had dinner. She said, I talked to Tom today, and I asked him if he was missing me terribly because he'd been gone now 2.5 weeks. He said, we enjoy our time together. We enjoy our time apart. And I thought,
that's great.
She was shocked.
That's probably a good shock, though.
Yeah, it was a good shock.
Yeah, it's a good shock.